I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, the founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows wine enthusiasts to access wine without removing the cork. So if you want just a glass or two from a bottle, the Coravin extracts just a portion of the wine and replaces it with argon gas. Greg is also the founder of Intrinsic Therapeutics, a medical device company focused on spinal disorders. Greg is a graduate of MIT, and he has degrees in nuclear and mechanical engineering. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
How does the Coravin work?
So the Coravin is a simple handheld system about the size of a rabbit cork pull. It works by passing a thin needle, a non-coring needle that actually was originally developed for medical purposes, through the cork. Then you push a trigger. Argon gas inflates the bottle, essentially. It increases the pressure on the inside of the bottle. When you let go of the trigger, that pressure pushes the wine through the needle and out of the spout and into your glass. You pull the needle out of the cork, and the cork, because of its elasticity, reseals. The key for us, really, is that we take advantage of the cork's natural elasticity to allow it to continue doing its preservation job. Mm-hmm. We just found out a way to get the wine out of the bottle without removing it.
Okay, so show me this. Where is the argon? Is that
the
this
capsule.
Here?
The capsule. The capsule actually goes in here.
Okay. So there's one in there now?
That's right. You can always tell by pushing the button you hear that's okay. The argon gas coming out.
How small is the needle?
It's a little bit over a millimeter. It's a 17-gauge needle, and it's actually a medical-grade needle.
It looks bigger than I was expecting.
Oh, yeah. You know, the cork is really the most elastic natural material, the structural material we've ever found. And really what I did was take advantage of its elasticity to be able to get a reasonably large-gauge needle through it to pour wine as quickly as possible.
What is the history of the cork in wine?
It's a good question. I read about it only after I developed Coravin, but the cork is really the best-tested wine preservation system that we've got. Wine's been around for about 8,000 years, as far as we know. It started in Iran or the Caucasus and spread its way, like all good things, across the planet. Cork in glass is an argument between the French and the English, as there frequently is. But the best records show that it was developed by a guy who manufactured glass bottles in England in the 1600s. And he just decided that if he used cork in glass, that he could seal wine and better preserve it. The biggest problem with wine was that it would oxidize over time. You couldn't preserve the flavors of it for very long at all, so it was drunk quite young. Once he developed that system of cork and glass, people have been enjoying wine over decades since.
What is cork made out of?
Cork is it's a biologic plant-like material, and it's got a really remarkable cellular structure where the cells encapsulate a little bit of air, but it's completely contained. They're really, really small, and there's lots of them. And that air and that structure allows it to be compressed actually upwards of 90%, and it'll recover the vast majority of its size. So it's been great for sealing things for a long time.
The traditional cork is being replaced by other closures over the last decade or so. Why is that shift happening?
Well, there was a terrible tragedy that happened. Most cork is made in Portugal and by the Amaral family, I think. It goes way, way back. It's a beautiful tradition. Portugal went through some political troubles and economic troubles in the 70s and 80s, and the Amaral family really was sort of kicked out, and the farms were taken over by people who really didn't know what they were doing. So they had bad storage practices, they had bad treatment practices that wound up producing subquality, subpar cork that wound up being shipped all over the planet, and in particular, south of the equator. So the Australians, the South Americans, and even some of the Americans in the 1980s were getting really poor quality cork that either resulted in early oxidation of their wine or the transfer of this really foul chemical called TCA. And so with those failures, the French and actually then the Australians developed the screw top, which is the most broadly used alternative closure.
And do the Portuguese, are they back in action with providing cork to the global market?
They absolutely are. And they have cleaned up their act dramatically. And the incidence of things like premature oxidation and tainting, cork taint, which is TCA, has dropped dramatically. I think when somebody comes out with a competitive closure that starts taking over, you respond.
Why does Portugal have a monopoly over the cork supply?
Trees live for 100 plus years. They take a long time to develop, and they like to grow in certain areas. So Portugal is the number one, Spain and France. It's a very European product, as I think it has been for thousands of years.
If the cork has this elasticity, why has it been so challenging to create a device such as the Coravin to preserve wine in the past or up until now?
I've always felt that the most challenging thing in developing a new product is identifying the unmet need you're trying to address. I've always felt that once you've really captured the need in a unique way, the product itself sort of falls into your hands. And I think what's been the assumption throughout history since the 1600s was that in order to drink a glass of wine, you need to remove the cork. And I think the fundamental step that I took when I invented this device was saying, no, I don't actually need to remove the cork.
Did you have sort of this epiphany moment where you're like, wait, actually, let me go about this a different way?
I'd worked on my first medical product was a needle product, one for J&J and then another one for Pfizer. So I had become really good at needles over the course of a few years. And I remember literally standing in my house with a needle in my hand and a bottle of wine in my other and thinking there's got to be a way that I can get this wine out of this bottle without pulling that cork using this needle. And I think the rest was quite easy.
And you had the coincidence of your wife being pregnant in 1999 when you came up with the idea so that you were basically alone drinking wine and you wanted to find a way to preserve the wine. Now, that's the anecdote. Is that just coincidence?
It always sounds so tragic. You're drinking alone. Yeah, it was the driver, certainly. My wife was pregnant. We always used to enjoy wine together. And actually, her taste has permanently changed as a result of her pregnancy, which is not uncommon. And there were, I think at first it was, look, I want to be able to drink a glass and not commit to the whole bottle. But then I realized, you know, what I really want and what's missing is a way that I can drink however much wine from any of my bottles at any time without having any compromise in the quality of the remaining wine.
By the way, you said your wife's taste, her name is Lee, has changed since her pregnancies. How so?
There are some good things and bad things about pregnancy. It's remarkable the vast impact that it can have on a woman's body in all sorts of unpredictable ways. And the sort of benign one that happened to my wife, she became super sensitive to smells and tastes. She's very good at picking up oxidation. She's been great in part of my testing as I developed Coravin to see whether or not wines had changed. But she really has lost a taste for strong flavored things like broccoli or truffles or wine of any kind. She's still a great wine detector taster.
So even decades after having children.
Yeah.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, co-founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows people to access wine without removing the cork. This allows a person to drink one or two glasses without compromising the remaining wine in the bottle. You use argon as the gas to prevent oxidation. And argon is a noble gas. It's an element. It's inert. And the Greek word means literally lazy.
Yeah. And it is a lazy gas, I guess. It doesn't, or it's an antisocial gas. It doesn't want to play with anybody. It doesn't bond to anything. I actually experimented with a variety of different gases over the 10 years it took me from the time I came up with the idea till starting the company. I wanted to see which gas had the least impact on wine over time. For me, the ultimate was if a professional couldn't tell the difference between a wine that had been accessed, I'd poured a couple of glasses out of the bottle years ago, maybe a decade ago, and one that had been untouched.
Yeah.
So argon very quickly rose to the top along with a few other gases, and I really wasn't able to tell the difference, as has been demonstrated by a lot of people that have tried.
Now, argon is heavier than oxygen, so it forms a blanket over the wine. Is that right?
That's right. It's about 1% of the air we breathe, but it is heavier than air. And that gives it some really tremendous advantages, both for the Coravin, and actually it's a commonly used gas in the wine industry during the bottling process.
I've heard the Coravin described as a mosquito. And for people who want to picture how the Coravin works, Just as a mosquito extracts blood using a needle, so too does the corvin extract wine. You had mosquito in the initial name, correct?
That three-year-old older son of mine gave it a very sticky name, literally from the start, wine mosquito. We dropped it because mosquitoes have also been responsible for malaria and, you know, millions of dead. So we've dropped it from our lexicon. But it was the name of the product between 2000 and 2011, when it was really just my device at home.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, co-founder of Corvin, a company that produces a device that allows people to access wine without removing the cork. This allows a person to drink one or two glasses without compromising the remaining wine in the bottle. You started Corvin from a personal need. Had you always been interested in wine?
I grew up in Southern California, probably had my first wine at a reasonably illegal age. So there's a wine culture in California, and I'd always liked it and been interested. I was introduced to one of the first most shocking wines that I'd had. It was an Hermitage from France, a red wine, and it didn't taste anything like a grape. It tasted like pepper and meat and all these strange things. And I thought, you know, how did this happen? And I think that's one of the pleasures of wine, is the exploration of how a single grape in different regions made by different people can in one place taste like blueberries and strawberries in Australia, taste like red meat in France, and be a spectacular drink in California with totally different characteristics.
And while you were a wine enthusiast, you are and were primarily a medical device inventor. At what point did you say, you know what, I'm going to take this invention of mine seriously?
I'd been making them for my own use for a while, and then one of my friends saw it. He's now one of my co-founders, and said, you know, can I have one of those? So I made him one. Then I had a very good friend, one of my investors in Intrinsic. He got married, and as a wedding gift, I made him one. Mm. And then people that they knew saw it and started asking for it. So I started making, I don't know, a dozen a month. And realized, hey, wait a minute, it's not just me who has this problem. There's a lot of people who have the same interest to try a variety of different wines and not have to commit to any of the bottles.
And this invention was marinating for, you know, over a decade. You first thought of the idea in 1999,
yep.
But it wasn't until 2003 that you developed your first prototype. And by the way, 23, 24 prototypes later, we now have a Corvin.
You know, I'm a perfectionist. It helps you in medicine because you never want to have a failure if you can help it. I am a scientist at heart. I want to make sure that it worked perfectly. And it was a side hobby, but it got to a point where I realized, you know, I've touched on something that people are passionate about, which is what really gets me going.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, founder of Corvin. We'll hear more from Greg coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, the founder of Corvin, a company that produces a device that allows wine enthusiasts to access wine without removing the cork. So if you want just a glass or two from a bottle, the Corvin extracts just a portion of the wine and replaces it with argon gas. Greg is also the founder of Intrinsic Therapeutics, a medical device company focused on spinal disorders. Greg is a graduate of MIT, and he has degrees in nuclear and mechanical engineering. When you say that you gave the Corvin as gifts, I mean, this, I'm looking at it, it's intricate. It's made of metal, and it's really solid. I mean, is it made in China? Or?
Yeah, it's so great. I think you look at something, and it looks beautiful. Now, this is how much the world has changed. You think it must be made in China or Germany. So it's a sad truth, but actually not a sad truth. They're both great places. I have a machine shop in my basement. I'm an inventor, and so I like to relax by making things. So I have been machining since I was in college. It's just something that's very peaceful for me, designing and machining. So I made them all in my basement.
Using what? I mean, it's made of metal.
Yeah. So I would cut it, design it, and cut it by hand. I probably would have been a watchmaker a century ago. I just love precision machining. Now I had the enormously good fortune of running into and being introduced to our current CEO when I was looking for a board member. Nick Lazaris, who really took Keurig, the single-serve coffee-making company, from pre-revenue to its sale to Green Mountain and then the billions that it added to their valuation. Really spectacular guy.
This is a coffee-making machine, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, the Keurig single-serve coffee maker. Nick had relationships with a spectacular manufacturing partner in Hong Kong and China. Without them, Coravin would not have gotten to market.
Another key ally or person for you in this endeavor is Robert Parker, the wine critic. He basically has given it a wet kiss, which he never does. The last time he did it was with Riedel glasses, I believe.
Yeah, Riedel from Austria. I had the really good fortune of being introduced to him by one of our investors. Robert Parker is just what he appears. He is completely unbiased by industry and by me. And actually, he was, when I was invited to see him by this friend, I remember sitting down to dinner and he looked at me and he said, "I just wanted to let you know, I don't like gadgets. I don't think they work. I really don't understand what it is you're doing, but there's no way that this could possibly work." So I brought out a couple of bottles that I had been drinking, actually that had been rated well by him. He is the one that I followed for a while to try to, and still do, to really explore the wines of Hermitage and all these things that I loved. So I poured him a glass of wine from a bottle that I'd accessed probably 6-8 years ago. And as soon as he tasted it, he looked at me and said, "You know, this is the biggest change I've seen in wine in the last 34 years. I think I had a permagrin for about, I still do." He's a spectacular guy.
A permagrin. I like that. So was he just trying to be cheeky, you know, when he said, "Just want you to know I don't like devices," or was he actually being, you know, factual when he sat down with you?
He's a direct guy. And I think you need to be when you are in the wine rating world. It's a pretty hard-nosed world.
You were introduced to Robert Parker by your friend Jerry Facciani.
Yep.
How did you meet Jerry Facciani?
Jerry came to an investor meeting. I was trying to raise money, actually, for Coravin, our first big round here in New York. Jerry shows up at this meeting, and he starts helping me to set up for my sales pitch to this investment fund. And I'm thinking, who is this guy? Since then, and many people have told me the same thing, you meet Jerry Facciani and you fall in love with him right away.
So he's just a stranger who came up to you at a conference and he liked the product and he just wanted to be helpful?
Exactly. And he was close to Robert Parker and made the introduction by email and then was there when we went to dinner saying, "You know, Bob, you really need to see this."
We talk about key opinion leaders, and Robert Parker is that for you. Can you talk to me a little bit more about key opinion leaders in the medical device world?
Absolutely. The medical device world is very complex. There are regulatory, there's not only the human body and its pathology and the thing you're trying to solve and the variability from person to person, but there's also the regulatory world. Then there's reimbursement. More and more reimbursement is the number one challenge that a med tech company faces. The people that many of the government regulatory agencies and payers turn to are physicians that are the heads of their societies or have written extensively on a topic that you're working on. And it's exceedingly important to go see those folks very early on in the process, perhaps involve them in your clinical trials, so that they are aware of you. They know why you are trying to solve the problem, what problem you're solving, what you're good for, what you're not good for, so that when the agencies and the payers call them, they are informed. And if you don't, there can be a hostility. Why didn't you come see me? You know, why did you ignore me? So in having the experience of making mistakes in the med tech world, I brought that same philosophy of going to the key opinion leaders in the wine world first before we launched. And that was the top sommeliers in New York and San Francisco, the top wine producers in California, the top wine raters, both here in the United States, Wine Spectator, Robert Parker. Also over in Europe, Jancis Robinson, had the tremendous pleasure of meeting her. These are all really good people that have worked their way into positions of authority and trust.
So you benefited by getting the attention of these people early on, even before the ultimate development of whether it's a medical device product or the Coravin.
Yeah, I would do it in every company that I start.
It's striking to me that in the medical device world that they need to feel like they were in on it early.
I wish the medical device world were more objective. There are complex political issues associated with medtech, as you can see even now. So despite there are some companies that are successful despite bad clinical results, and there are some companies that are very successful or very unsuccessful despite excellent clinical results. Mm-hmm. And the difference between them is really, to some extent, partially involved with the luck and relationships that are developed early on.
In addition to Robert Parker being a key person for you in making the public aware of this, you mentioned some sommeliers in New York City were key. First was Mario Batali's restaurant, Del Posto, and now 11 Madison Park uses it. How important was that?
It was really, really important. And actually, we're replicating the same thing that we did in the U.S., in France, and in Germany, and in England right now. We would bring together a group of sommeliers at a dinner. Access a half a case of a wine. So we'd take half of it and we'd access it, pour it, explain the system to them, wait 6 months, invite them back to another tasting, have them taste blind to see if they could tell the difference between access and unaccess. This is 6 months out, some of them 9 months out. Number one, it was validation that we functioned, that it worked. That was really important. And number two, these people are deeply connected in the restaurant scene, in the press.
Was there any other key person or pivot point for you that's helped to get the word out?
Retail wine stores have been enormously important for our success. And they're great. They demonstrate the product. They can pour people wines before they buy. They can help them to explore regions of wine, to teach them, you know, what is an oxidized Italian wine, this type of thing that you would never have experienced before.
Now, I have to admit, my husband is a fan, but when I first heard of this, I thought, really, do you really need to spend $300 on this device? Like, does one really need that?
You have to tell me. What's your conclusion? I'll try to bias you in advance. I think it's, what Coravin is not a preservation system. Really, the advantage that Coravin provides, it's a new category. It's wine access. You can drink from any bottle you have at any time. You can serve any bottle you want in a restaurant or at home. You can pair wines. You can learn 6-10 times as fast about wine. And part of the pleasure of wine is its variety and and your understanding. You go into the average wine guy's home with a Coravin, or woman's home with a Coravin, and on their counter, they'll have 6 bottles of wine. And they're drinking across those bottles over the course of a week, trying to learn something.
So if you reframe the picture from wine preservation to wine access, then it really changes the experience of wine drinking.
I think so. It changes. People have written me long letters where they say, look, you've changed my life. I had this cellar of wine that I wasn't drinking because I didn't know whether or not it was ready. And then all of a sudden, I start to access this wine and I'm tasting more, sampling more, learning more, understanding more. Leaving the cork behind to do its preservation job is a really important thing.
How did you get the name Coravin?
Coravin was a knockdown, drag-out naming fight that took us months. Cor is the Latin root for heart, and vin from France, wine. So the heart of wine was what we thought, and brings in a little bit of my medical background and my love of wine.
Your co-founder is Josh Schmackauer, a medical doctor. He's on the board of Intrinsic, your medical device company.
Josh Schmackauer is one of the most extraordinary medical innovators on the planet, and an open-minded, optimistic guy who believes that absolutely everything can change.
What's an example of some of the devices he's invented?
Oh, he developed probably dozens. I think he has 6 or 7 companies running at a time. And one of them was Acclarent. Acclarent is an enormously successful company that solved one of the biggest problems in sinus surgery. People that have chronic sinusitis from a clogged nasal sinus. He developed this way that you can push a balloon up in there, inflate it, open up the sinus, pull it out, and you walk out of the doctor's office feeling better.
I love the transfer of technology in general from one industry to a very disparate other industry.
I think that it's always good to have the most open-minded and innocent people involved in the understanding of the problem and the creation of the first new idea. Mm-hmm. Frequently, the best ideas come from people who are outside of the industry because they're not biased.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, co-founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows people to access wine without removing the cork. This allows a person to drink 1 or 2 glasses without compromising the remaining wine in the bottle. I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about your medical device profession. You founded two companies. One is called Viacor, which allows subcutaneous cardiac valve replacement. And that company, the intellectual property connected to it was sold to Medtronic in the 90s?
Or? Yeah, it was an actually, it's a company of success and failure. It was my first medtech company. My mother has a leaky mitral valve. I tend to work on the problems of my family. And aortic valves, an aortic valve failure is a very quick cause of death. Viacor tried to fix the mitral valve through a small stick in an artery in your leg and a vein in your neck. And this, instead of having a cracked chest, open heart procedure to fix your mitral valve, we thought we could fix it percutaneously while you're awake. Unfortunately, we had some issues with luck. We had some issues with financing and management. So the company ultimately wasn't successful.
But the IP, the intellectual property, was sold to Medtronic.
It was indeed.
And are they using that process now?
You know, you find out whether or not they're using it when they contact you for patent extensions. So I'm constantly seeing new patents with my name on them from Medtronic. So it makes me happy that they're using it.
How many patents do you have?
I've lost count. Over 100.
Now, you mentioned Viacor just had ill luck. What's an example of that? Aside from management, which was subpar.
Raising money is a key skill of a CEO, and our CEO really wasn't terribly skilled at it, but a great, great guy. We had the misfortune of having an adverse event right when we were raising money. Mm. And despite the fact that we may have been better than any other procedure that's out there currently, bad timing can get you.
So you had tried the procedure and it didn't work.
In one patient, yeah.
A more recent company that you founded is Intrinsic Therapeutics. It's a medical device company focused on spinal disorders. Here, it's connected to a personal experience of your mother who had sciatica. Can you explain what it does and how your mom benefited from it?
It sounds like I only work on products with my mother. The most common problem in spine is a herniated disc. Herniated discs compress a nerve that goes down your leg and you feel this shooting pain. You get loss of function in the leg, loss of the ability to lift your toe off the ground, for example. The fundamental problem is that the disc is ruptured. It's like a tire, and the stuff on the inside of the tire comes out and compresses the nerves. We're a very intricate tire patch.
You've always had an interest in making things and fixing things. Did you, as a child, what are some memories as a child just being very hands-on and producing things?
I never really tolerated things that didn't work. I was also very positively influenced by my grandfather, who was a weapons designer during the last century. He sort of ignited my interest in making stuff, and the two of us would tear apart a bicycle and then rebuild it together. He was really my inspiration.
There's a story about him advising you not to make weapons, but to make things that were more positive. Can you describe that further?
Yeah. My grandfather was an Austrian. He wound up developing one of the first jet engines and then missile guidance systems for Germany during World War II. He was captured by the Americans in 1944 and was lucky to have been so, as he always told me. Wound up working on missile systems here in the United States, along with many other German scientists. And he came up to me, I think it was 1981, I was 11 years old, and he said, "We've made enough weapons. You should do something else. Medicine or power? We'll never have enough of either."
By the way, he was Austrian, so he was on the enemy's side of history.
Yeah.
How have you reconciled that?
Yeah, it's I was not involved, obviously, in what went on. And it was a terrible, terrible tragedy. And the Germans did some horrible things, as they know and as we know. I think ultimately what you try to do is take the best of it. And if I can work in medicine and make people's lives better, if I can work in wine, something that people are really passionate about. I had a surgeon tell me, "I understand your career. You make stuff to fix us so that we can live longer to enjoy the wine that we really like." And I took that to heart. And so I think part of the influence of the negativity of World War II was to try to take my grandfather's experience in really destroying things and turn it into something positive.
And this is a man you love, obviously, but, you know, have you dealt with that complication?
Yeah, and, you know, I think people in World War II walked away from that experience being on the wrong side, one of two ways, either with, or maybe a combination, terrible guilt or denial. And when I talked to my grandfather about it, I remember I didn't have long with him. He felt both. Every country has its epic, disastrous behavior. You know, we had the slave history. We just need to recover, move on. Luckily, the younger generation seem much better informed.
Now, you mentioned you lived in California, but you lived in New York City in the Village up until you were 11. Do you have any memories or that feature in your past about what you're doing now, if anything?
Yeah, I think that the difference, if you were to contrast two places in the U.S., you could pick Newport Beach, California, and Manhattan, radically different. So, you know, New York kids go to the museum, right? They're interested in art and music. They don't get a whole lot of time on grass. It's a very intellectual world.
And was that for you?
It was. And I love that about New York. And then California is about the beach. It's about cars. It's about how you look and where you live. And actually, that was very informative as well. I became a big surfer. I love it. I loved it out there.
And in a way, this contraption is a fusion of those both.
It is. And art and design have to meet up with purpose and functionality. I personally think that Corvin's a beautiful system.
And revelry.
Yeah, and joy, that's true. And there are joys on both coasts. I think they come from different places, but they're on both coasts.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It was really my pleasure.
My guest has been Greg Lambrecht, founder of Corvin. Coming up, we'll meet Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a condiment company. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a ketchup company. Mark and his co-founder Scott Norton thought, why shouldn't there be a gourmet alternative to Heinz ketchup, and started tinkering with recipes in their off-campus apartment while they were students at Brown University. Sir Kensington's was launched in 2010, and the product is available in stores throughout the United States, including Williams-Sonoma, Dean & DeLuca, and Whole Foods. The product is also available in more than 500 restaurants and hotels. Sir Kensington's also makes other condiments, including mustard and mayo. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start in September 2004 with an article written in the New Yorker magazine by Malcolm Gladwell called The Ketchup Conundrum. Basically, the gist of it was that while mustards enjoyed a variety of flavors and various companies made them, ketchup could not share that same diversity. Only Heinz had kind of this perfect blend of sweetness and sourness and bitterness and saltiness, in addition to mouthfeel, which is called umami. Can you tell me about your first encounter with that article?
Yeah, we had this idea of ketchup long after that article came out. We didn't read it in 2004. We were in high school and we weren't highbrow enough. And we had this idea when we were seniors in college in 2007, 2008. The article was brought to our attention. We read it and we thought it was very interesting. I think, you know, in many ways, the food world is very different than where it was in 2004. You know, in 2004, Chobani didn't exist. Coconut water didn't exist in America. And so many things have changed since then. So, you know, when we were reading it, we had a very different perspective on what's possible. We thought that he made a lot of great points around product. Ketchup is a very nostalgic flavor. The mouthfeel, like you said, those things are really innate in people. What stood out to us is that there wasn't a lot of discussion around brand, whereas Grey Poupon really has a fantastic brand and was, he mentions, as sort of a breakout star of the mustard category. We didn't really perceive there to be a lot of ketchup brands that were doing something interesting in the same way.
He talks about this concept amplitude, which basically is a balance of flavors, and that Heinz had a high amplitude. And I have to admit something embarrassing, which is that the article came out a month before I was married, and I thought when I was giving a speech at my wedding, what am I going to say? And I used this concept of amplitude about my husband in my wedding speech.
That sounds perfect. Yeah, completely perfect. Yeah. You know, amplitude is present in everything that we eat, everything we consume, right? It's sort of, in the way that it's talked about in the article, it's sort of how intense can the flavors be, and how often do you want to keep going back to that flavor, or how long does it take you to get tired of it? Mm-hmm. And I think Coca-Cola has a lot of that, has a lot of amplitude. You don't taste one thing in Coke. You taste many things. And so for me, having something that has high amplitude means it's balanced.
The article wasn't the germ or the inspiration for you to launch the company. How did you get the idea to start the ketchup company while you were at Brown?
Yeah. Well, the legendary answer is that we were reading about Sir Kensington in history class, and he was part of the British aristocracy and quite a culinaire. And there was a long-lost recipe that he had sort of helped develop after he went to a dinner party at the home of Catherine the Great, and he was served a ketchup that was subpar, so he needed to make his own, and we brought that back to life. Mm-hmm. The real story is that we had the idea to start the company just in the course of normal conversations around food. I mean, we were both... I have a Lebanese and British family. He has an Armenian family. And so there was always cooking going on growing up and lots of family feasts. And food was always a very central part of our lives. But we were both econ majors. So we were always talking about food ideas and ways to sort of find the intersection there. And we were just saying how weird it was that if you go to the grocery store, you're overwhelmed with choice, you know, whether it's cereal or yogurt or salsa or milk. But in this one category that is in 97% of American homes, we didn't think there was any choice.
By the way, we talk about Heinz as this, you know, behemoth incumbent. But Henry Heinz was a maverick of sorts. You know, in the late 19th century, there was a preservative in ketchup called benzoate. And he contended that this was actually not good for your health. And he replaced the preservative with vinegar, basically pickling the tomatoes. And he won out. But it was because of his moxie that Heinz was born.
Yeah, I mean, the story of H.J. Heinz is incredible. And we're lucky that we don't live in the world of the late 19th century. The food world was scary. I mean, before truth in advertising laws and before sort of consumer protection, that people were putting all sorts of stuff in food, making all sorts of claims. And food was, in general, not super safe. And H.J. Heinz was really one of the first entrepreneurs to take food safety very seriously. And that was the origin of the glass bottle, which was he wanted to make sure people knew that he was proud to show what was inside. And so I think that, that resonates with us.
Heinz is this iconic Americana brand, and you sought out to do something distinctly different by making this absurdly highbrow, making fun of yourself, but foodie-oriented condiment. When we say that you tinkered with recipes during college, tell me more about that.
Yeah, so it was the spring semester of our senior year. Neither of us were writing any sort of thesis, so we had plenty of time. And we just started Googling ketchup recipes. And we had really no cooking background at all. I think at most I had cooked pasta in college, and Scott had probably cooked less than that. But he had an off-campus apartment with a stove. Ketchup, to make it, in theory it's easy. In practice, it was extremely difficult. We didn't even have aprons, so we cut up trash bags to use as aprons. We didn't have proper gloves, so we used oven mitts. You know, we didn't have any pot bigger than a saucepan, so it took us weeks and weeks. And I think that off-campus apartment still smells like tomatoes. And we developed 8 different recipes that we thought were pretty good. And we hosted a series of tasting parties with our friends. And our first tasting party was the night of the biggest blizzard that Brown had seen in years. But people showed up with snow pants under their dresses, and they helped us taste all these ketchups and give us their feedback.
What is a Kensington kiss?
So Kensington kiss was the result of not having proper protection while cooking ketchup. We didn't have, you know, the right aprons, gloves, or whatever. So a Kensington kiss is what we called the burn marks on our skin when the hot tomato ketchup would boil off and splatter all over us.
So this is senior year of college, and you both went off to do different things prior to starting the company. You worked at McKinsey in New York after graduation, and Scott went on this bicycle ride throughout the Middle East and Europe. At what point did you come back to this idea of starting the company?
As we were graduating, the idea was sort of what we thought was coming to a close. We made two formulas that we thought were great. We had a big launch party, sold all the jars we made, and that was going to be it. But we had a lot of friends who were saying, this is a cool idea. You should at least keep working on it. So actually, over the course of 2008 to 2010, we worked nights and weekends on Skype and however we could get in touch, really putting all the puzzle pieces together. And then in 2010, we had gotten it to a point where we felt like it was just waiting for someone to take it over. So I quit my job in June of 2010, and he joined in October.
We talk about the legendary start of Sir Kensington's. How did you come up with the idea of being tongue-in-cheek and being, you know, what you called absurdly highbrow in getting the concept off the ground?
When I was growing up, I was always attracted to brands that had personalities. That doesn't necessarily mean literal figurative personalities like a, you know, like a Mr. Peanut. But I think brands need to make statements, and Heinz clearly makes a statement. It stands for childhood, it stands for nostalgia, it stands for fun, and really, it stands for Americana. And we didn't want to go right up against that. And I think, you know, as much as food is about quality and taste, it's also about entertainment. So we didn't want to make anything that was too, we didn't want to take ourselves too seriously. So Sir Kensington evolved as this character that hearkened to British quality and British cuisine, which in some ways isn't looked at as the best cuisine in the world, but it's certainly looked at as sort of like high tea and, you know, it's the origin of a lot of things fancy. And Sir Kensington was this character that personified these sort of tongue-in-cheek ideas that you could have quality even in the lowliest of things.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a condiment company that got its start by making a ketchup that hoped to be a gourmet alternative to Heinz. What is the history of ketchup?
Ketchup actually is a 500-year-old condiment. It started as a fish sauce in Southeast Asia. It's originally a Chinese word. I think it's pronounced ketsiop. And it sort of migrated with the spice trade from Southeast Asia through Central Asia. And it eventually incorporated tomatoes, which are a new world crop. The tomatoes are from Peru. The Europeans brought tomatoes back to Europe, needed a way to preserve them. And ketchup eventually made its way to America.
So in 2010, you and Scott decide to launch the company officially. You debuted at the Fancy Food Show. And how pivotal was that for you?
For us, that was that little four-foot table that I was standing behind with my sister made all the difference. That's where we met Whole Foods. That's where we met Dean and DeLuca. That's where we met Williams-Sonoma. And I think in many ways we were incredibly lucky that they stopped by because we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't know how pricing worked. We didn't know what distribution was. I mean, we didn't even have a warehouse. The first order of product arrived at my apartment doorstep, and it was a pallet. I didn't even know what a pallet was. I was in a doorman building at the time. Doorman called and said, "You have a delivery." I said, "Oh, great. You can just put it in the packages room." And he's like, "No, no, no. This is thousands of pounds of I don't know what." And so I had to come back, and I sort of helped him unload it and put it all in my apartment. So I had a wall of ketchup in the apartment at the time.
What was harder for you initially than you thought it might be?
Well, sales were hard, still are hard. And so we were taking our cases of product door to door up and down streets of New York to places like Murray's Cheese, places like the Chelsea Market. You know, but it was hard, though, because people are busy. They see a million products a day. It's only gotten worse. These jars of ketchup were heavy, so I had them in a like a rolling suitcase. And I would go into these stores, and the stores would be filled with people. I mean, it's Manhattan, so there's no room for anything. And I'm in there with my suitcase trying to get them to taste this or see this. And they, you know, they'd just say, "I'll leave a sample, and I'll call you back." And the nice people do. But most people, even if they are nice, are too busy to call you back. Figuring out that you have to sort of be persistent while still being nice was a tricky balance to find.
Any interesting anecdotes about, you know, approaching Murray's Cheese or, you know, you mentioned Chelsea Market or, I don't know, anything that sticks out?
Well, I think the first thing is our very first New York retailer was Chelsea Market Baskets, which is a store still there, great store in Chelsea Market. And he was willing to put it up on shelf. We had most of the product in my apartment. We had some product in a warehouse near where Scott and Brandon were from in Northern California. And so our first attempt to ship, we didn't know that you had to pack glass properly. And we would get these irate calls. You know, I have a box that's bleeding ketchup. There's glass everywhere. What are you doing? And so I had to start hand delivering every week, you know, these boxes of ketchup all around the city because we had no other solution.
How did you finance the company in the early days?
In the early, early days, we put in our own money. It was me, Scott, Brandon, and there was a fourth partner named Wynn, who was also a college friend of ours. But as soon as I decided to leave my job and do this full time, we started to raise a bit of money from family and friends. We tried to raise money from people who were not just supportive, but had done something like this before. So some of our investors have also invested in brands like Pop Chips and Vita Coco, and we've tried to raise money from people who know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so to the degree that we can continue to raise from people like that, that's going to help.
What are some mistakes that were made that perhaps, you know, they helped with?
It hasn't all been easy. We've made a lot of mistakes. One of those mistakes is saying yes to every store that wanted to stock us right away. It was certainly in the early days just an amazing compliment. So we said yes to everyone. And so very quickly we had product in Arizona, in Texas, in Maine, in New York, California, all around the country. And I think the dirty secret of the food world is you have to be ready to support that. Mm. You know, things don't just fly off the shelf. And so we learned the hard way over the course of 2 years. We were getting into more and more stores. We weren't really paying attention to if once it got on the shelf, was it getting off the shelf? Did anyone know about it? Was anyone willing to pay? And so we had to go through a period of really pulling back. And it was actually one of our board members who has done this before who said you should really lean into your best customers. And for us, that was Whole Foods.
What are the sorts of things you did other than, you know, stand there and demo, allow people to try the product?
Stores, in many ways, make their money off of vendors, not off of the people who are buying stuff in their stores. So a lot of stores, they'll charge what are called slotting fees, which are, you know, you have to pay just a flat fee to get your product on the shelf. But then to move it, you can do things like demos. But also, anytime you walk into a store and you see a display, you know, at the end of an aisle or sort of by checkout, that's usually paid for. And so being able to have that kind of placement makes you a little more attractive, certainly more visible, because it's also on sale. We found that that has the biggest impact on sales. And also hardest to get, because everyone's done this math. Everyone wants those kinds of displays.
Do you have any better answers for why Heinz dominated the market for so long, other than this amplitude answer that Malcolm Gladwell has?
I think that Heinz built their brand brilliantly by being ubiquitous. You know, something like 70 to 75% of all ketchup is consumed in food service, not in retail. So food service is basically anywhere you get ketchup for free. Restaurants, hotels, travel, schools, whatever. And it's usually Heinz. And so when you go to buy ketchup at home, you're going to buy what you're familiar with. And so for us, from the very, very beginning, it was always about how do we work with restaurants and how do we be omnipresent?
You're in more than 500 restaurants across the United States. What are one or two stories about getting the ketchup, getting your ketchup into one of those restaurants?
Our big break, I would say, on the restaurant side is working with PJ Clark's. I mean, they're an institution for burgers, and they've been serving the burger since 1884 with Heinz. I mean, the chef, his name is Mike DeFonso, phenomenally nice guy, very busy guy. And this was really our first lesson in how to sell in restaurants. There's no sort of process there. So we showed up, he tasted it, he said it was great, said he would call us, didn't call us, busy guy. So actually for like 4 months straight, we would just keep showing up at his doorstep. And he would always laugh and he'd say, "You guys, what do you want again?" And then eventually he said, "I want to do it, but my boss won't let me," the owner, this guy, Phil Scotty. And then, you know, for another 6 months, we were going back and over, trying to get a meeting with him, kept getting blown off. And then finally, he allowed us 5 minutes in his office. And the first thing he said to us, and he was this like legendary guy in our life, right? Almost a year trying to reach this man, Phil. He turns to us and he says, "You are the most f-ing persistent guys I have ever met. What do you have for me?" And so we told him our story very briefly, and he was a smoker at the time, and we gave him an engraved Zippo lighter with PJ Clark's on it, and it was really sort of the way to his heart. And we're now very close to him and his wife Thea, who's been like a godmother to us, and it all happened, and it was all because it was non-traditionally persistent.
I noticed that you're married. You have a ring. When did that happen?
Well, what's funny is I spent 2008 to 2010 at McKinsey desperately trying to find a girlfriend, and I couldn't. And the moment that I quit to start Sir Kensington's, I decided now I really should be single so I can really focus my time on building Sir Kensington's. And then at the Fancy Food Show, I met Rachel, who is now my wife.
What was she doing at the Fancy Food Show?
At the time, she was a partner at a design firm. Hmm. And so they were looking at packaging and trying to find cool, interesting new clients. And she and her boss had stopped by. They were too expensive for us, so we started dating instead. And now we're married.
What might I not know about you? What do you enjoy doing outside of work?
Well, I love spending time with Rachel. I also love cocktail culture. I was very briefly a bartender at a bar downtown called White Star, and I learned how to chisel ice from Sasha Petrosky, who's the founder of Milk and Honey, the seminal sort of pre-prohibition or prohibition-style cocktail bar in New York. And I started doing these bar nights in my apartment while I was at McKinsey. The whole idea was to create a space that was fun and was lubricated, but not insane. You know, wasn't sort of a 10 shots for $5 kind of place, but also not the kind of place where you had to whisper. And over time, it took on sort of a life of its own, and I created a menu, and people were bringing people I had never met before, and it got up to something like 40 people, and I had almost 100 bottles of liquor in my apartment, and it lasted for almost a year, and it had a name. It was called Mark Bar. I have plans to have sort of an underground bar component to Rachel's Cafe when it finally launches.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.